for great-looking t-shirts, hoodies, and sweatshirts, the TNT Shop is now open at tntradio.live. The conversation continues with Sonia Poulton on today's News Talk, TNT.
Oh, I thoroughly enjoyed talking with Lois. We wouldn't necessarily agree on sort of fundamental principles of things, maybe to do with pro-life, et cetera, but I completely support her campaign that people can speak freely and without criminalization. Teresa Wilde said, it's a crazy clown world. This trans stuff makes my head hurt. It's so mental. I ask people on a daily basis and the general public aren't buying it, aren't accepting it and don't want it. Parents need to kick this out of schools. It needs to be pushed out of schools, says Teresa. We've had, Shug said, all laws in Scotland are null and void, but they won't tell you that. Indeed, they won't. Now, let me refer to a very interesting letter I received from Tony G. Good morning to you, Tony. I am wading through those emails. Tony wrote in and he is absolutely outraged that Kate Middleton claimed to be receiving NHS standard chemotherapy treatment. And instead, he points me to GC Math, which I talk about in my film, The Business of Cancer. He said, Kate's chemotherapy is a crime in itself. And many people do absolutely believe that. He points to the work of Lynn Thayer and David Noakes and GC Math in the treatment of cancer for which David was imprisoned, very, very sadly. Tony rightly said, there is too much money coming into the charities to allow a cure. Now, there are 500 diseases that have been identified as cured by GC Math, a perfectly natural substance, which every fit human, has as their immuno anchor and cures everybody's 50 to 70 cancer attacks every day. Total cure. Kate is being murdered. I can't claim that it is a total cure. I don't know, but I do believe we are allowed opinions around here. And that is Tony's, and he is absolutely entitled to it. Now, excuse me, something caught in my throat. Now, I don't get to say this very often, but a man has been given a custodial sentence for downloading child abuse images. And I don't get to say it very often because magistrates' courts routinely do not give custodial sentences for people who are downloading child abuse images. It is a well-known fact that they are these people who are involved in downloading these images are not considered a threat to the children. They are not considered to be child abusers or paedophiles. But that is absolutely ridiculous. Absolutely obscene. They are culpable. They are the marketplace without whose participation there will be no market for the abuse of children. Anyway, the person that I'm referring to has a very interesting background, which is why I wanted to highlight it. His name is Ian Nash. He's from Cheshire. He's a cyber forensic expert. And he has been branded a danger to children after he was caught with what was described as a horrific stash of child abuse images on his computer. But here's where it gets interesting. At Chester Crown Court, the judge said that Nash had a serious problem. But the thing is, Nash has been working for MD5 Limited, a digital forensic company, which provides virtual forensic computing software to law enforcement agencies. So as well as Interpol, the FBI, National Crime Agency, Homeland Security, Australian Federal Police, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, and all local police in the UK. So this man has been supplying work to all of these law enforcement agencies, and he was only caught when he was leaving his job and he handed back his device and there were these images on it. So he even has the temerity to use it to a man who is involved in, you know, cyber issues to do with law enforcement, even has the temerity to be using his work device for his disgusting habits. So I'm actually really glad to see that he has been jailed. And I would like to think that this was the start of something new, because it's a real bugbear to me that you have people, including former NI cop Jim Gamble, who was very much involved with safeguarding children. I've heard Jim Gamble before saying you shouldn't have prison sentences for people who download child abuse images. Absolutely ridiculous. There are literally people who have been in prison for stealing bottled water. That occurs. There are literally people who have been imprisoned for not having a TV license. That occurs as well. How can people who download child abuse images, and as with the man in Swindon, over a million images, not be in prison? So I welcome this development. And as I say, his name is Ian Nash and he's from Cheshire. And on that note, let's go to Gemma for a second time today for the UK news headlines.
It's the stuff.
What citizen wouldn't want to make American great again?
People are talking about.
Vilifying MAGA, it's just not going to work.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
And here she is. Hello, Gemma. Gosh, it really literally feels like only an hour ago since I last saw you. I love these twice a day chats with you. What's on your radar right now?
Well, I just have to make that comment, you know, that people, many, many people have been put in prison, mostly women, mostly pensioners on very little money, have gone to prison for not having a television license. You know, so just think about that. Think about where our society is skewed, how it is skewed. And just on that subject, it's a horrible subject to have to talk about at all, ever. But, you know, some people, child abuse campaigners, you know, survivors, associations, the official figures are 1 in 10. But I did some stories on child abuse, and actually when I was in the BBC, following on from people who were downloading and not getting custodial sentences. I was speaking to a few campaign groups, and they say the figure's more like 50% and up. And they said child abuse isn't part, it's not part of our society, a lot of campaign groups say. It actually is our society. When you look at the figures and when you look at survivors groups and so many people still, especially the older generation, have taken that secret to their graves. You know, there's a whole raft of stuff about child abuse, not just in the UK, but globally. Paedophile culture, paedophile planet. I don't really want to go into it. It's a very dark subject for a hump day, but, you know,
It is.
But the way you've just illustrated that story, you know, they don't send people to prison for downloading horrific images, but they will put you in prison if you don't prop up the matrix by buying your mainstream media brainwashing card. You know, it doesn't
It doesn't make any sense. And the reason I wanted to highlight that story, I know these are tricky subjects, certainly, you know, first thing in the morning for UK folk. But the reason I wanted to highlight it was also because what this man actually does in his professional life, that he works with law enforcement agencies, the absolute irony, and that he would have the nerve to download these images onto his work computer, the arrogance. Or is it arrogance? Or is it just that he has this sort of, you know, and also, he blamed the disintegration of his marriage on him downloading those images. I mean, please get a life. And but I do think it is a welcome development that he's been jailed. And I think that's about time, and we need more of that. So, it is unsavoury. Let us move on. Have you got any good news at all for us on Wednesday?
Well, it's a weird one today. And just to go back to that story, I don't want to, but I have to just make that point as well, is that, you know, is it a coincidence he was working for a law enforcement agency?
Ooh.
You know, is it? Is it? You know, Anyway, let's move on.
Good headlines point, really, though. Good
well,
point.
Yeah, if you're in the chat, put your own comments in. So it is Wednesday. The headlines broadly haven't changed since last time we spoke, but you know, the main story is still public confidence in the NHS in the UK now is at an all-time low, according to a survey, yearly survey that's carried out and has been carried out for 40 years. Gauging public satisfaction with the NHS that we pay for here in the UK. As we mentioned last time, the church is under attack from the Home Office. The Home Office says the church's procedure of converting asylum seekers to Christianity so they can stay in the country is undermining the whole process and needs to be looked at properly. And the jobs apocalypse, AI could threaten 8 million jobs could be lost in the UK over the next 3 to 5 years as AI continues to grow in its sophistication and its ability to do jobs that human beings currently do. Women and part-time workers and the young are currently the most at risk from the frightening rollout, a think tank has said today, of new technology over the next 3 to 5 years, which could wreck the economy.
I think that's the one that we have to go in on, because I'm particularly curious why they believe that women and young people are going to be most vulnerable to this. Any idea why they're saying that?
It's the type of jobs that AI can currently actually do. This has come from the Institute of Public Policy Research. Entry-level and part-time and admin jobs are the most exposed because AI can actually do routine cognitive tasks at the moment. So at the moment, the jobs that are under threat are data management, scheduling and stock-taking, which affects the secretarial, admin and customer services jobs. That's 11% of the UK population. They looked at 22,000 roles and looked at the roles that AI can currently do. Customer services is one of those. And I don't know if you've ever been ordering anything online, but of course you get these little things that pop up up. Oh, how can I help you? Do you want to chat? You know, that's not a human being. It would have been a human being in the past, customer services, but you're now talking to a robot. So this is where the creep is already coming in and taking away jobs. But the second wave, which is what this report is saying, it says as AI gets more sophisticated, it won't just be jobs like that, customer service, secretarial and admin jobs and data management. It will be copywriting, graphic design, database creation and coding. So currently women are at the most at risk because they do secretarial, admin and customer services jobs where it's not already been taken over by a robot. But the second wave, as AI becomes increasingly sophisticated, that's where the 8 million figure. I mean, this is based on modeling, but it's quite sophisticated modeling. And they say any economic growth by replacing humans with AI will be cancelled out because those humans won't have jobs. So they won't be spending money and the economy will stagnate. So the think tank is saying to the government, you know, use AI, but use it to boost growth and enhance living standards and boost productivity. Use it in the right way. They're not actually coming down on the technology itself. They're saying it's the way it is used. One of the senior economists at the think tank says AI is a game changer. It's developing at such a fast pace. It's becoming creative. It can create text. It can create images. It can create data. It can create all. It's creating all the time. So we're now at a fork in the road. And if employers, unions and the government doesn't act now, then it may be too late. And the robots' rebellion will be upon us, except it won't be us rebelling against the robots. It'll be the robots rebelling against us and taking away all our jobs. 59% of the second wave jobs could be potentially, well, 59% of jobs in the UK could be potentially affected with this. Now, you could say it's scaremongering. You could say, oh, you know, the Institute of Public Policy Research, it's a worst case scenario. It's a modeling scenario. It is. But look at where we've come in the last few years is AI. You know, you phone up a utility company, you phone up your bank, it's a robot. You go and buy something online, you chat to a robot. I mean, I had a bit of fun with Amazon a few months ago. I was ordering some stuff for the studio, which I could only get online, which I hardly ever shop online. So this thing comes up at the bottom. I was having a problem with some equipment. So I had a bit of fun with it. And it said, hi, my name's Alan. Can I help you? And I was typing in, you're a robot, mate. And he was going, no, how can I be a robot? I have a name. And I was like, this, you're a robot, you're a robot. And it was a robot. But it's not funny because previously, if I'd had a problem with a piece of equipment, and I would have talked to a human being. So right. is this a worst case scenario? Or is this something, you know, we talk about the transhuman agenda, we talk about merging of us with technology. It's already happened. Everyone's addicted to their phones. I think there's a lot to be said for this report. 8 million jobs within the next 3 to 5 years. Mm-hmm. The way AI is going, it can make art mm-hmm. now, can't it, AI? It can make poetry. You Terrible. Just won't know. You won't yeah. know if you're dealing with a robot or whether you're dealing with a human when it comes to the workforce.
I'm not convinced this is good for business, though, and I'm really glad that you were able to have fun with it. But I also had an experience quite recently. Last year, I bought a carpet cleaner from Currys, and I've been shopping at Currys for decades. I have bought so much electrical equipment from Currys, but I bought this carpet cleaner. It broke down very, very quickly, and it's a good brand, Vax. Anyway, trying to deal with Currys was almost impossible. I ended up being put through from one automated system after another over a period of a week. In the end, I was just so incredibly exasperated. They pushed me from pillar to post, again, that robotic language. And I ended up going to Vax. They dealt with me directly. They immediately sent me a new carpet cleaner. And I said to Currys, I will never buy another thing from you again, because it's all about selling. Sell, 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 and forget any aftercare. And that was definitely my experience. And I know that I'm not alone, because I actually tweeted about it. I ended up with lots of people commenting, saying I've been through exactly the same situation, not just with Currys, this is happening. So ultimately, I'm not convinced this is going to be good for business, because you cannot beat having a friendly voice on the end of a line. And I don't know if you've ever read The Tipping Point, but The Tipping Point is about how legal actions occur. And there's a chapter about doctors, for example, and it says that the vast majority of litigation against doctors would not have occurred if there was a more human touch approach to the initial complaint. And that is part of the problem. I can see now that we're heading into a whole new arena where people are going to get so ticked off. They're going to be, you know, probably issuing all manner of lawsuits because they've been led astray by some robotic instruction or irritated. So I just don't think this bodes well. And I do worry about it replacing creative arts, because the whole point about creative arts, it is
it's us, it's our creation. It comes from our human experience. That's all part of the richness, the rich tapestry of our lives is in creation. So all those things deeply, deeply concern me. And I don't think we're wrong to be concerned, Gemma. We've seen how these people who are putting these sort of things into effect, how they all already want to impact and control our lives. So I think we're right to be concerned.
Absolutely, we're right to be concerned. And there have been warnings about this for several decades now, with people warning about, you know, the transhuman agenda, the merging of the man and machine, the human and the machine, and also the aspect of taking away the very bit that makes us human, the empathy, creativity. Some people say about creativity being the seat of the soul. You know, if you're creative and you're creating your day-to-day life, that is a part that can never be replicated by AI, except I've seen some art that has been done by AI, and you're like, wow, that's incredibly beautiful. And the AI did it in 30 seconds. You put in what you want to have on the image and it does it for you. It's actually very, very, very sophisticated. But, you know, if you want to get conspiratorial, which if you're in the chat, you might want to do, you know, this whole transhuman thing, which everyone says, oh, it's a conspiracy theory. It's not a conspiracy theory when you're looking at these figures, which has been done by a serious think tank here in the UK. 8 million jobs replaced by robots. Well, that's not a conspiracy. That's a potential reality. And also, you had the the MOD with their merging of the man-machine dynamic, the literature, it was a couple of years ago now, I think, or it's 2021, that whole way they were going to augment the human to make them better defense, defense units, as it were. So it's not really conspiratorial to think about where this is going and the end of humanity. And also with people being addicted to their smartphones, especially the young, and the effect that that's already having on the brain, where they look at the technology and they have more of a relationship with it than other human beings. We're already halfway there with the younger generation, I think, and the impact that's having on their mental health, because the technology they've got and they're wedded to is stopping them from being human. And they've got this epidemic of stress and depression now amongst 16 to 24 year olds because they're not developing in the right way as a human. So I think there's a lot to be sort of taken apart with this report. It is a modeling scenario, but as this guy says, we're at a fork in the road and it's how we handle it now. And unfortunately, you know, government will be at the forefront of this, as will employers. And government and employers, they care about profit, don't care so much about people. So let's see where this goes.
Indeed. Thank you so much. Vital report. We will keep an eye on that. This has been Wednesday's edition with Gemma Cooper. I'll be right back.
TNT's David Curtin.
In my mind, government spending in the UK is absolutely horrendous. It has got completely out of control over the last 14 years of Conservative rule and 13 years before that of Labour rule. You would probably be astounded if you actually knew how much the government spent in this financial year. These are the figures. The estimate for how much it wants to spend on everything, or how much it needs to spend, is £1.2 trillion, or 1.2 million million, if you like, which is an amount of money that we cannot really comprehend.
David Curtin on today's News Talk, TNT. Today's News Talk Radio.
Come on, let the man talk.
We never censor our hosts.
Good. Now, talk.
Uncensored news.
Today's News Talk Radio. TNT.
Well, Gemma has managed to frighten the life out of me, as she's almost certainly capable of doing. Excellent news. Shin, who is a regular commenter on the Sonia Poulton show and other shows, actually, she says, I have good news. After 7 years of legal battles, we have won full custody of our 14-year-old. Now, that is fantastic news. We love that. We're a community around here. And one person's pain extends to all of us because they chat like dear old friends in the chat. And listen, Shin, that is fantastic news. Love to all of your family. We're rooting for you. And absolutely brilliant news, isn't it? It is wonderful. Right, where are we? Well, we've just obviously, Gemma's just freaked us all out with her AI report. We're going to move on to something completely different now. I'm delighted to be joined by Kerry Knox. Cox. She's head of family support at Families Outside. Now, you may or may not be familiar with Families Outside, but it's the only national charity in Scotland. It works exclusively on behalf of families affected by imprisonment. You have your hands full, Kerry. How are you this morning?
I'm good, thank you. And you're absolutely right. We do have our hands full. Unfortunately, you know, it's never a good thing that we've always got people to support, unfortunately, but that's just the way it is, isn't it?
It's so necessary what you do, because many people forget the hidden cost of imprisonment. We automatically focus, obviously, on the person who's been in prison. We forget about the family and all the attendant problems that often are sort of inherent in this situation. And one of them, of course, is poverty. And I know that you've recently commented on the child poverty report, which I find absolutely devastating. I was born into poverty, so I absolutely understand it on a very, very basic level. And it breaks my heart, even many years on, when I'm not at all impoverished. And I always make sure to raise awareness around it, because I find it absolutely obscene. In the fifth richest nation in the world, that we would still have poverty. It is obscene. But so obviously what we've seen is the recent child poverty stats published last week, and it shows that child poverty level in Scotland, they say, have remained broadly stable. But what does that really mean, and how is that in, how does your work impact this situation?
Yeah, so I guess what I would start with saying is, when family members in prison, the costs of supporting someone in prison disproportionately falls to single women who are already on a low income. So if we look at that in itself, you know, we're encouraging child poverty just by having a family member in prison. And many families will experience food and fuel poverty as a result of that. We have spoken before about, you know, the meaningful contact with a family member in prison, which will have a positive outcome for all involved, including children and young people. But what's not recognised is how that can be really challenging for families to maintain that. So to improve their mental well-being, to improve and maintain relationships, we need to see families being connected with the person in prison. But as I said, it is a challenge in terms of the costs associated with that. So if we just think about some of the costs that are associated with having a family member in prison, we're seeing that families are having to spend a lot of money for paying for journey visits, you know, because not necessarily their family members in a local prison to them. They could be hundreds of miles away. So we're still seeing them having to pay for that cost. We're also seeing family members having to top up money for the person in prison, you know, so that they can top up their phone card, or they can maintain the contact with the family, they can buy personal items. So that cost falls to the family as well. And there's things like, you know, when their family is visiting, they're still going to have to pay for refreshment costs, especially if you're taking children to a visit. If you're out the house for so long, then there's costs there that you're having to kind of pay to feed your children and things. So when we're looking at the costs associated to imprisonment, it's just adding to the child poverty things, because these are additional costs that not all family members will have, but there's no financial support along with that. So it does just add to that kind of, you know, what a family can afford and what the family will go without. So yeah, that's kind of where we're looking at the child poverty, is the additional costs that families will incur when they have a family member in prison.
I mean, it's an important angle to cover. And the reason why is, of course, is because, as I say, so much is overlooked when people are imprisoned. I'm sort of the mind that we seem to be imprisoning a lot of the wrong people and not imprisoning a lot of the right people. Is that, I mean, I know it's a very, very general statement, but do you encounter situations where you're dealing with people who you just think they should not have been given a custodial sentence?
I think, you know, it's quite difficult for us to kind of comment broadly on that. But I think what we see is, maybe when we look at the women who are given a custodial sentence, we want to kind of try and look at, make sure that their every other opportunity has been considered, especially when children are involved. So we'd like judges and sheriffs to be looking at the impact of a custodial sentence will have on the whole family. So when children are there, what's the impact on children when someone has been given a custodial sentence? Is there an alternative to custody? We'd just like people to kind of look at that a bit broader.
It is very, very tricky indeed. And according to your own figures, there are between 20,000 and 27,000 young people with a family member in prison. That's huge. I watched this video that had been produced by, I think it was Lenzi Academy. I actually cried. I thought it was incredibly emotional and beautifully put together. And it was about raising awareness of the support available to these families. But it is difficult. Where do you receive your finances from?
But that's always a challenge for third sector organisations. But we are supported by the Scottish Government to some level, but we are just frantically always looking to access charitable trusts, grant funders. So it's a mixed bag, I have to say, in terms of, and it always remains a challenge trying to make sure that we have enough funds to kind of grow, because, you know, the demand is so high, and we are, although we're a national organisation, we're still relatively small, and that's where we rely on partners supporting us to kind of, you know, acknowledging their own remits, what they can do. So we offer accredited training for professionals who might come into contact with children and families affected by imprisonment, so they can support them in their own remit. You know, we're there in the background, but actually everyone should be able to support families. And I think that's, for me, it's the biggest thing we can do to tackle stigma, is everybody talk about it. What can everyone do? Because imprisonment will affect all parts of a family's lives, whether it's housing, finances, education, health. Everyone has a role to play there.
I think what you're doing is huge and immense. And let us come back to it and continue this conversation after some news headlines. We'll be right back.
Hey, I got news for you.
TNT Radio News.
It's about time.
Matt Boyland here with a look at your TNT headlines. Russia has accused the US and the UK of working with Ukraine to orchestrate last week's deadly terrorist attack in Moscow. There's been an awkward exchange between two journalists inside the Kremlin, with a Russian news chief delivering a spectacular smackdown to a BBC reporter. And Argentina's president Javier Milei is reportedly planning on firing 70,000 government workers in the coming months.
Globalist agendas, democratic rights at risk, corruption, propaganda. It never stops. For the news and views silenced by the mainstream media, by government and corporations, vote one. TNT Radio. Free speech always has a home here. Stay up to date with the latest live news and current affairs delivered by our lineup of expert commentators and hosts. Listen to TNT Radio anywhere you go. Ask Alexa or Google to play TNT Radio, or download the TNT Radio app for free from the App Store or Google Play. Today's news talk. This is TNT Radio.
I can see in the comments that Drumstick is asking if I'm taking an Easter break. No, not to my knowledge, Drumstick. I'll be right here, right, to antagonise you on the morning, as I always am. Not at all. I embrace you, don't I? Really important conversation we're having here with Kerry Knox, who's the head of family support at Families Outside, which is a charity, a national charity in Scotland, working exclusively on behalf of families affected by imprisonment. And what Kerry is having to say here, it's quite astonishing, because Kerry's organisation is actually dealing with deep problems that are impacting society. They're getting, you know, some money from the Scottish government, but you're basically having to rely on the goodness of the public, largely, aren't you, in order to be able to do that. And it's a huge remit, actually, Kerry. I don't think, before I started talking to you, I really had fully taken on board every element of what you're having to deal with. And so, for example, is it also about keeping families together, what you're doing? And that, I mean, that in its own right is like you've almost got a social worker role as well.
Yeah, so where families want to maintain positive contact with their family member in prison, it is about making sure that we, while that person's in prison, we're trying to support the family to create a stable environment. So, you know, so they have good housing, they're financially set up, the children are engaged in education, they're looking after their own health and well-being. Because ultimately, if that person's going to return to the family home, we need a stable environment for them to be given any chance of not reoffending. So, you know, what we are doing is trying to work with the family, right, okay, you've been thrown into chaos. How can we now support you to live a comfortable life until your family member returns, but for them to then come out to a settled environment, you know, because there's evidence there to say that if a family member in prison maintains positive contact with their family on the outside, they're less likely to reoffend. So it's up to 6 times less likely to reoffend if they've got a stable environment when they come home. So we're not doing it for the person in prison, we're doing it for the family unit to make sure that they can continue to be a family when they're released from prison.
I think it's vital. Your mission, as you say, or rather it says in your booklet, is to improve outcomes for children and families affected by imprisonment. Your vision is to see that people are treated with justice and fairness, and you say so that they can live healthy, active lives free from stigma and disadvantage. That's a huge request, isn't it? Because children of imprisoned parents are already stigmatized. How do we even begin to tackle that in society?
You know, for me, and it sounds really simple, but we just need to keep talking about it. We need to have, you know, more raising awareness things within a school setting to say, you know, it's okay to talk about imprisonment, because we see children that we support, they've either been told not to tell anybody their family members in prison because, you know, you just don't know what's going to happen, what people might say to you. But actually, the only way we'll break that down is if we do make it okay to talk about someone being in prison. So, you know, can we do more in schools to kind of say, let's have an assembly about what does it mean to have a family member in prison? Mm. You know, what would you do if your friend's family member was in prison? How could you treat them? So it is about talking about the subject and kind of making sure that people feel okay to raise it, because what we see is families not accessing support because of the stigma attached to it. And the only way we'll do that, as I say, is kind of keep talking about it, have awareness flyers everywhere about, you know, there is support available. And you shouldn't feel ashamed. You know, you've not done anything wrong. Families are not guilty. So they should be able to ask for support. But unfortunately, that's not the case. And we see some families really struggling in terms of, you know, not even accessing their support from their GP because they don't want to go and say why they're feeling really down. So it's a massive problem. But I think the more we talk about it, the more we get the messages out there that families are not guilty. We should be supporting them. The children have rights, you know, if they want to maintain contact, they've got rights to do that as well. So it's about just keep talking about it.
And obviously, we started by talking about child poverty, and we know for a fact that poverty is a huge determinant in terms of crime, certainly for working class criminals, for want of a better description. And so do you work with the Scottish Government about overcoming these issues so actually that may indeed reduce crime?
Mm-hmm. So we're involved in a number of like different policy briefs and things with the Scottish Government. What we try to do with the Scottish Government is anytime they are looking at a policy consultation that might be around the criminal justice processes, you know, whether it's about, I don't know, bail and release or something that's specific for the person in prison, what we will try and always do is get them to look at these policies, considering the impact that they will have on families. So if we involve the family impact in all of policies and practice, we should be able to start seeing more joined up approach and thinking, actually, to achieve this, we need to put support in place for the family, not just the person in prison. I've always said that when someone goes to prison, there's so much support around them, whether they choose to accept it or not. There's opportunities for people in prison to engage in workshops, you know, programs. But when we look at the support for families, that offer isn't there, and it should absolutely be mirrored in terms of that. So that's why we want the Scottish Government to kind of always think about the impact. Any changes that are coming into force, always think about the impact that this might have on a family member. The same with the prisons as well. You know, when prisons are putting regimes in place or anything, changing visits, transferring people from prison to prison, think about the impact that that's going to have on a family member, because it's huge and it's just something that is not overly recognised.
Absolutely. Your impact report, of course, you say we continue to support the implementation of the recommendations about the deaths in prison custody. And you actually, it comments that this is sadly on the increase. That must be a hellish situation to deal with, that first of all, a family is dealing with a loved one in prison and then they're dead. How do you even begin to address such a sensitive topic?
It is. But for us, it's about being there for the family. What do they need? What do they need support from us to do? And unfortunately, what we find ourselves doing is as kind of being the liaison person between the prison, you know, between health and trying to get answers, because that's what families really want. They want answers that sometimes people are shying away from giving them, or the answers are taking too long to be given to the families. And you can, you know, as you say, it's bad enough that your family member's in prison and you're not able to have that daily contact. But when they've passed away, not having the answers that you want right there and then is very difficult. And we're seeing some families not getting answers, you know, for years, and just trying to live with that. And how can they really move forward with their own life when there's still so many uncertainties about what's happened to their family member?
It's so painful. I can't imagine the true impact on children of any of these situations. As I say, first imprisonment and then death. What you do is absolutely vital. How can people listening support you?
I think what we would like to see change is, you know, we need to see more information. And this might sound really simple, but it's a massive thing that we hear from families, is there needs to be more of information available for families at each stage of the criminal justice process. So right from arrest, what can Police Scotland be doing to support families at the point of arrest? You know, we know a third of children will witness their family member's arrest. That's a really traumatic experience for children. So how can we kind of look at ways, and I know arrest can't always be planned, but is there something right there in terms of offering support at the right time for families? So thinking about each stage, so at the arrest, when someone's going to court, how does that impact people? What information is available there for families? Because when someone's sentenced, a family member doesn't even know which prison they'll be taken to. How can we support families at that stage? So it's about more information to make sure that families understand what's going to happen next, how they can get information around maximising their income to make sure that, you know, they're not going to be in financial stress. And just kind of allows them to plan a little bit better. But as you said, the other thing that we need to do is to tackle a more targeted approach to tackling the costs of supporting someone that's in prison, so which will contribute to the child poverty plan. You know, particular issues requiring about looking at supporting families with a high maintaining cost of travelling to a prison, and supporting families with things like the loss of child maintenance. You know, if a family member was receiving child maintenance from a partner, they're now in prison, that automatically stops. So how can we kind of support them more financially? But longer term, we need to see systemic change need to happen, kind of, for example, reducing the remand population in prisons. It's huge. And that kind of, you know, we're seeing families where people on remand, that they're spending up to half their income per month on supporting someone who's on remand. So we need to reduce the prison population, especially the remand population.
We certainly do. Kerry, thank you so much for joining us this morning. I'm sorry I have to cut you off there, but what you're doing is absolutely phenomenal. Everybody, this is Kerry Knox from Families Outside. She is doing God's work himself. Take good care of yourself. Thank you for joining us this Wednesday on today's News Talk. We'll be right back.
My name's Stacy, I'm 57, and I was adopted in 2020.
We were adopted in 2019.
And we were adopted in 2021.
We had a house, and it sounds crazy, but it wasn't a home. The one thing that Jake and Emma brought is it became a home.
When I met Dakota, he had just turned 14.
You weren't there for the first this and the first that. I missed the first words, but we got a lot of other firsts.
Watching her say, oh my God, I cannot believe I got my license. And she's like, I passed. And I'm like, girl.
See them grow. It is.
They chose to love us. They didn't have to. They chose us. Family.
You and you.
Kids in the middle.
What I thought was a complete life was nowhere near complete. But it is now.
Learn about adopting a teen from foster care. You can't imagine the reward. Visit adoptuskids.org.
One in four Australian women experience domestic violence in their lifetime. Staying is dangerous, but leaving can mean homelessness for them and their children. With your generosity, the Salvos can provide crisis services and ongoing support, helping women find a way out of violence and a way back into a safe and stable life. Help us leave no one in need. Please donate to the Red Shield Appeal today.
This is the Sonia Poulton Show on today's News Talk. TNT.
Well, the very lovely Kerry Knox has got huge support from all the comments coming in. Craig O'Bath said, we're living in a society where compassion and empathy are gone. Polarization is the new norm. Indeed, it is. And we have to get back to who we are, and that is being human. But according to Gemma Cooper, we're getting far, far away with it. Obviously, with the advent of widespread AI. Gosh, it just boggles one's brain, doesn't it? Now, talking about which, I referred at the top of the show to something else that boggled my brain yesterday. That was this really weird, bizarre handing down of the judgment to do with Julian Assange, met with extremely mixed reactions, obviously, and quite naturally. Stella Assange described it as astounding and many other things. And many see it as a continuation of his abuse at the hands of the legal system, while others view it as a glimmer of hope. I am going to be joined right now by Taylor Hudak, who was with me before. Excellent journalist. You've covered this journey, haven't you, Taylor?
Yes, I have. Thank you for having me.
It's always a pleasure. So what were your thoughts when you saw that judgment yesterday?
You know, let me just say this. This judgment was very strange. It initially had us all very confused. We really had to, when I say we, I mean us journalists, really had to read through this judgment itself to fully understand exactly what this judgment meant. But initially, you know, at first glance, at that, you know, initial moment that we learned of the judgment, I welcomed it. And I thought, oh, this is great. He's going to be given, he meaning Julian Assange, is going to be given permission to appeal on 3 of the 9 grounds. Of course, we would prefer for him to be able to appeal on all of the grounds, but 3 of the 9 grounds, I felt, okay, this is welcome. However, that's actually not really what the judgment stated. In fact, what they stated, what the High Court is allowing for, is for the U.S. government that is being represented by the Crown Prosecution Service, as well as the Secretary of State in the UK, to offer assurances to these potential 3 grounds for appeal. And that these assurances are basically just not necessarily pieces of evidence, but just some additional information provided to the court that will alleviate any concern about a potential abusive process or the death penalty, having not a fair trial, those sorts of things. So the U.S. government is given permission, first of all, to provide the court with these assurances. So the permission to appeal is not really a permission to appeal. We could go through specifically what is to come in the next few weeks here, but it was a very bizarre decision, a little bit confusing as well for us journalists, and I think the public at large. But the good news is that Mr. Assange will not be immediately extradited to the United States. That did remain a possibility before yesterday. So in that sense, this is somewhat of a small victory, the fact that he's still able to fight the extradition.
I agree. I mean, with a situation like this, you almost have to take what you can get, right? And as you say, at least they didn't, you know, decree that immediately he should be packed on a plane and sent off to a land that allegedly even tried to kill him. And that's what concerns me, Taylor. Let's look at those 3 points, because this whole idea that America can give assurances of his safety. I mean, I've spent rather a lot of time in the High Court over the last few years, and I struggled with this judgment. Because like you, like everybody else, major news outlets, even WikiLeaks themselves originally interpreted it, you know, in the way that we all did, which again is really bizarre. So those 3 points, how can America truly give those sort of reassurances, do you think?
Yes, well, let me be clear and just let everybody who's listening right now know that these assurances are not assurances at all. My biggest concern, though, is that the High Court will take these at face value without question and then go ahead with the extradition. That is my concern here. But basically, the 3 counts that the U.S. is allowed to provide assurances are on concerns about Assange's freedom of expression being under attack, and this is contrary to Article 10 of the European Convention on Human Rights. The other point is this idea that Mr. Assange would not be provided, not be given a fair trial in the United States, that he would be discriminated against on grounds of his nationality. He would be prejudiced because he is an Australian citizen, because he's not American. He would not be granted the First Amendment protections. And then the last point is the death penalty. So the United States would have to be able to just state he will be given First Amendment protections. This is not a violation of his freedom of expression, and that he will not be subjected to the death penalty. However, these assurances, it's written in law that they can be overturned at any time. So they don't really mean anything. And the U.S. has a history of violating assurances in cases of extradition. This has happened in the past, and it's a real concern with this case as well. So again, it's on those three, but really 2 points. That is death penalty, assure that he won't be subjected to the death penalty, and also assure that he would be given First Amendment protections. Now, technically, he is not facing the death penalty right now. The concern is that once extradited and on U.S. soil, he could be subjected to additional, or he could be charged with additional crimes, let's say treason, for example, which in the United States does carry the death penalty. And so that was the concern and where this question of death came into the court.
I mean, one of the issues that really concerned me, and indeed Stella highlighted it outside the court, was that the fact that the courts have not agreed to look at the evidence that the US had plotted to kidnap him. Now, what obviously is very alarming about that, and as Stella so rightly pointed out, because if they did, they couldn't send him to the States, full stop. What were your thoughts about that?
I shouldn't be shocked, but I still am a little bit, that they are not taking this into consideration, because what the UK is doing is that they are considering potentially allowing for a man to be extradited to the very country whose intelligence agencies conspired to assassinate him. And in this judgment, they dismiss this point about the assassination. They not fully, but they pretty much dismiss it, stating that it's no longer a concern. The concern at the time in which the assassination and the kidnapping was being plotted was they wanted him on U.S. soil. But if extradited, he will be on U.S. soil. So this would not be a concern if extradited. That's actually the logic that they put forward. I know it's a little bit confusing, but let me just recap again. What they have said in this judgment is that the assassination and the kidnapping of him is not a concern once on U.S. soil, because at the time that the kidnapping and assassination was being plotted, he was not on U.S. soil. I hope that makes sense. It's bizarre logic. It feels even a little bit silly to even convey this information, because it is just so illogical.
I found the judgment fairly illogical and weird, and just felt very twisted. And the other thing, of course, that Stella said is that the Biden administration, far from issuing assurances, they should just drop the case. But that's not going to happen, is it?
I hope they drop the case. I agree. That's what should happen. This case should be dropped. And there's actually a piece of legislation in the United States that's being put forward that has bipartisan support from people not only on the conservative side, like say Marjorie Taylor Greene, but also those on the liberal side, like AOC. It has a bipartisan bill being put forth that is basically advocating for Assange to be released and for the charges to be dropped. So I'm hopeful that the Biden administration will do the right thing. That's what we would all want, of course, for those of us that are advocates of free speech and free press. But I'm a little concerned that that may not happen in this case. But I'm still, that would be the best outcome, of course.
And it was interesting when I was reading through it, one of my first thoughts was the courts have invited political intervention here. And that was exactly what Stella actually said. She said that the US has managed to show the courts that the case remains an attack on press freedom. She said clearly the fact that they've invited this political intervention shows that this is a political case. Your thoughts?
Absolutely. It is a political case. And historically, espionage charges have been viewed by the courts as being inherently political charges, and the court dismissed this point, which is very interesting. It seems that they're doing everything that they can to allow for this extradition to go ahead, almost bending over backwards for the United States government to have just one more opportunity to make its case when they have had 5 years to present this evidence. They've had five years to present this evidence, to provide these so-called assurances in the court. They had every opportunity to do so. So it's very concerning that the courts are giving them just one more chance to do this. And again, as I said earlier, I'm very concerned because historically with this case, U.S. assurances, which were brought before the court in 2021, were accepted by the high court at face value without question. And I'm a little bit worried that that's going to happen again this time.
This is not your fault, but you've literally confirmed all my worst fears about this. And you're somebody who's far more well-versed in the Assange case than I am. But the thing is, the delay also continues to lock him into this legal system without being charged with the crime, as you say. And as we've said repeatedly, the process is clearly the punishment for Julian Assange. It's almost like they just want him to die in prison. Am I being over dramatic there?
That's interesting. I've heard others make this point as well. I think it would be not, it would not look good on the UK justice system, on the US justice system. Of course, he's in the UK right now, but of course it is these two governments that are persecuting him and prosecuting him. But exactly, this process is just going to be dragged out any further. Now, extradition processes do take quite some time. But just for the listeners to kind of make sense of what's ahead, the respondents, that is the US government and the UK Home Secretary, they have until April 16th to provide these assurances that we've been speaking about. If those assurances are not provided, then a leave to appeal will be granted. I know that they're going to issue those assurances. I have no doubt they're going to issue those assurances. And if they are provided, which I believe they will, the parties will have to... they'll be able to submit additional arguments on why there should be a leave to appeal or why there should not be a leave to appeal, taking into consideration these assurances. And then a hearing may take place on May 20th. And then it's almost like we're having to redo this previous hearing that took place in February. So it's just being further delayed, and it was a very bizarre decision. I'm very curious as to how much this deviates from a typical extradition process. That's still a question that I have, actually.
Well, when you have that answer, please come back and share it with us, because as a job of a journalist, I read judgments day in, day out. And I was literally scratching my head and I was like, this is not making any sense. This looks extremely bizarre. Obviously, there have always been concerns, haven't there, about whether any of the judges who have overseen the series of hearings, whether they may be too closely associated with the British establishment, with the secret services. And I think that concern remains, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. One of the judges and who was overseeing this previous appeal hearing did have close ties to the British establishment. This has been a pattern with this case. But the one thing with this stage was the fact that both of these judges are at a very high senior level. They're not up for any promotion. So that was hopeful in this case. But yes, it is concerning. I mean, courts are corrupt, of course, but I'm hopeful that people in positions of power will continue to try to do what they can to secure his release. As I said, we're seeing legislation being put forth in the United States, and I'm hopeful that this case will be dropped because it doesn't look good for the United States. And every time that the U.S. and its officials call out other countries for their abuses of power, human rights violations, or freedom violations, those other countries, other world leaders are able to point back to the Assange case and the U.S. prosecution of him. So I'm hopeful that there could be some sort of, that this could be dropped and that the legal process thesis.
Us sincerely hope so. Taylor, thank you so much for joining us this morning, bringing clarity to this most bizarre of judgments regarding Julian Assange. Have an excellent Wednesday, Taylor. Take really good care of yourself. And Taylor is almost brought us to the end of Wednesday's show. And before that ends, there is a news story that I had picked up that I wanted. Well, it's not even made the news. And that's what's so intriguing about it to me. So basically, this week and right up until, let me check the date here, right up until the the 16th of April. The Future of News, Impartiality, Trust and Technology. It has been receiving oral evidence in Parliament, has involved a series of mainstream media journalists and producers such as Louisa Compton, who's head of news and current affairs at Channel 4, Deborah Turner, chief executive of news and current affairs at BBC. And these people who are absolutely part of legacy media, because I haven't been invited to testify, and I'm pretty sure nobody at TNT has, but all of these people that have been invited to submit oral evidence to this committee are all from legacy media. And the idea is to examine the changing media landscape, what needs to happen according to Parliament to ensure a thriving, trusted and financially sustainable news ecosystem. Well, what I have to say would probably be banned at this time of the day, or indeed any time of the day on broadcasting, but who knows, who cares at this moment. But I am concerned about that, because it's very interesting that mainstream media are involved, and yet I've seen absolutely no reports about this in media, not even in media newspapers. How curious is that? And on that note, because we're all full of curiosity around here, I think we're about to wrap up Wednesday's show. I want to say absolutely wonderful thank you, tremendous work to the team who have brought me and the wonderful guests here. I truly appreciate you all. Stick with TNT. You know this is where it's happening. We attempt to bring you news literally on the minute and make it impartial, truly impartial, because this is about the truth around here. Thank you, everybody, for joining me today on every single platform. The whole team, stick around. I'll see you tomorrow. Take good care of yourself.